Listen and stream the all-new Talk Radio Freedom 106.5 for the only talk that matter.
Good morning, good morning, good morning, and welcome to Freedom 106.5 FM, where you speak your mind. It's Carrie Vinia Company going all the way to 12. I want to thank Satish for holding on the past three for us. But we're going to jump straight into Doctors on Call with Dr. Nadira Rambukas. Good morning, Dr. Rambukas, and how are you?
I'm good, Cara. Good morning, Cara. Good morning, listeners. Good morning, Dr. Richards.
Hi, good morning.
We have a special guest today, Dr. David Richards. He's a young and vibrant ear, nose, and throat specialist surgeon with a special interest in sleep medicine, rhinology, skull base, and facial plastic surgery. He has invested many years of study both locally and abroad to acquire a BSc in Medical Sciences, MBBS, Doctor of Medicine, and otolaryngology. He has been involved in medicine for over 11 years. He is also passionate in inspiring and uplifting his community and by extension the nation to live a healthy lifestyle. He sees himself not just as a typical surgeon, but health and wellness expert and influencer with his many charitable efforts, in particularly his work with the Diabetes Association and the health fairs he hosts to promote wellness. So we want to welcome Dr. Richards today.
Welcome, Doctor. Welcome to Freedom 106.5 FM.
Thank you very much for having me.
So, Dr. Richards, how long have you been practicing medicine?
So, practicing just over 11 years now. I must say it's been a quite challenging but enlightening journey.
And what was your motivation for choosing medicine, and in particular, ear, nose, and throat?
Quite a funny story. Initially, when I just started form six, upper six, I was actually applying for chemical engineering because my family had a background in the oil and gas industry.
Right.
Yeah, but yeah. Initially when I was a little and a toddler, I had an interaction with a doctor by the name of Dr. David Cormano. He's a very famous dermatologist, and he was instrumental in starting the skin clinic in Port of Spain.
Right.
And because he was my namesake, I was actually, I used to say, you know, I wanted to be a doctor just like Dr. David Cormano. But when I started, when we were supposed to submit our application COE, something just dawned on me, and I changed last minute from chemical engineering to medicine.
Did you regret that change since?
No, I don't, no regrets. I think it was divine design.
Yes. And have you enjoyed ear, nose, and throat surgery in particular?
Yes, yes. So initially what I wanted to do, neurosurgery, because Dr. Ben Carson was another person I looked at in the space of medicine, reading his books, The Gifted Hands particularly. But there was a need for ENT in the country. We had quite a shortage when I was considering residency. And I ended up starting to go to the clinics, and then I liked it. So I ended up doing my specializing in ENT. And it's quite a interesting field. There's never a dull day.
So could you explain to us what is ear, nose, and throat, the study of ear, nose, and throat otolaryngology?
Right. So otolaryngology, or sometimes referred to as otorhinolaryngology, is actually one of the oldest subspecialties in medicine. Back in like the 17th century or so, we used to actually be fused with eyes. So it was like eyes and ENT, and then the specialties separated. It's basically the study or the specialty that deals with anything from the base of the skull straight down to the top of the chest, to the pleura. So we have a saying, we sometimes call it pleura to dura. So dura is the lining that covers the base of the brain, and pleura is what covers the lungs. So anything between that we deal with. So face, eyes, sometimes nose, mouth, oral cancer, throat, all those things.
Right. And we're going to talk a little bit about what your specialty is, especially with respect to sleep medicine. What exactly is sleep medicine?
So sleep medicine is quite a new specialty. It actually didn't exist maybe past 20 years back, right? So there are a lot of bodies that come in together to regulate it and so on, particularly the American Academy of Sleep Medicine. Before that, sleep was kind of the area of pulmonologists or respiratory medicine, ENTs, because we assess the upper airway, and sometimes neurologists, because there are a lot of sleep disorders that is neurological. But now they're actually sleep physicians or sleep medicine physicians, and actually in the process of completing further postgraduate studies in sleep medicine. So sleep medicine is basically the study of anything sleep related. So from your insomnia to your obstructive sleep apnea, restless leg syndrome, people who have night terrors, sleepwalking, all those things. There are over 80 diagnosable sleep disorders. So what do you imagine that? So it's a big area, and there's a lot of research coming out of it. And the way we sleep literally affects our lives. It's very important because for almost a third of your life, you will be sleeping.
And on average, would you say how many hours persons require sleep, and is it different for men and women?
Yeah, it's slightly different. It's recommended that you should get at least 7, yeah? But yes, different people are genetically programmed to function well on like four or five hours of sleep, right? But that's the minority. The most of us should get at least 6-7 hours on average. But it has been scientifically shown that it's beneficial to get catch-up sleep. So like for us professionals who have hectic weeks and we only get 5-6 hours during the week, it is beneficial health-wise to catch up on weekends when you actually have the time to, you know, to get that sleep in, because not sleeping well leads to a lot of lifestyle diseases like sleep apnea, right? Diabetes, hypertension, metabolic disease, and so on. Yeah.
Mm. Right. Dr. Richards, I want to find out, what is the most common sleeping disorder that you've encountered?
By far and by large in this country, it's obstructive sleep apnea.
Oh, okay.
But a lot of persons would have insomnia and other neurological types, which is more difficult to diagnose. But the one that you could see blaring at you is obstructive sleep apnea.
Mm. Okay, thank you.
So what are these symptoms and the causes of obstructive sleep apnea?
So symptoms, the number one symptom is snoring. Yeah? But yeah, not everyone who snores have sleep apnea, right? But by and large, most people who have sleep apnea will snore. So there's a spectrum, we call it the upper airway resistance syndrome, where you have people in and between from snoring to sleep apnea. And so it's a range, right? So you start snoring, but you don't have the criteria that meet sleep apnea. And then you could progress to sleep apnea. But let's pedal back and define what sleep apnea is. Sleep apnea is the cessation of breathing during sleep, right? And what apnea is, what we will call an apneic spell, is the cessation of breathing for 10 seconds,
right?
And the most common type of sleep apnea is obstructive sleep apnea, and that is cessation of breathing during sleep with a respiratory effort. So you actually try to breathe and your airway is shut off, right? So some other symptoms a patient might have, they might have morning headaches, daytime sleepiness, so excessive daytime sleepiness is a big one, problems focusing and concentrating, problems with short-term memory. Men may get impotency. Patients may have impotency, and the erectile dysfunction is common. Patients may have hypertension and difficult to control with medications. A lot of times when you see patients have requirements for 2 and 3 different medications to control their pressures, you should consider sleep apnea, right? Because it's there's a high prevalence of hypertension with patients with sleep apnea. Yeah. Right. Diabetes, uncontrolled diabetes, there's an association there. There's actually a dose-related relationship between sleep apnea and diabetes. The worse your sleep apnea, the higher the scoring, the more likely or the more uncontrolled your diabetes would be.
And what are some of the more common causes of obstructive sleep apnea?
All right, so we usually the patient habitus is like someone who's obese, right? Somebody who has weight gain, a large neck circumference, patients who may have craniofacial abnormalities, like high arch palate and so on, or any of those syndromic patients. Down syndrome patients tend to have sleep apnea a lot because of the craniofacial abnormalities. But the number one lifestyle one would be obesity. That's the highest association with sleep apnea.
And how can we diagnose obstructive sleep apnea?
So obstructive sleep apnea is diagnosed gold standard by a sleep study, right? Yes. Now, we have evolved somewhat with our technology with regards to the sleep studies. So previously, you would have been required to go to a laboratory and hook up to a lot of machines and a lot of sensors. And obviously that would not even sleep naturally with that. So they came up with other sensors and so devices that you could go home with. Some you could just tape it on your finger. You probably know about the Nitol disease, and also the sleep image device. Just you weigh it on your finger and you could actually diagnose a host of sleep-related disorders from it. So what it is usually works by like the telemetry method. So you send all your parameters and it uses a algorithm to formulate a score.
Right. And once you've been diagnosed with obstructive sleep apnea, what is the treatment?
All right, so once you've been diagnosed, it depends on the severity. So there's mild, moderate, and severe. And that is based on the scoring system with the amount of apneic events that is experienced throughout the night. Mild, we usually advise patients on lifestyle modification, starting to exercise, dieting, right? Avoiding alcohol before bedtime. If they have acid reflux, controlling the acid reflux, easing up on the pepper, spicy foods, no nighttime meals. The last meal should be 3 hours before you sleep, and things like that. So those are things that you could control. And actually, a big one is, we call it practicing of proper sleep hygiene, right? Going to bed at set times, actually going to sleep, not falling asleep, right? Taking off the TV, taking off all blue light before, so that your body actually goes to sleep at a certain time, which is, very helpful. In the moderate to severe category, people may require CPAP, right? And as of now, CPAP is the only treatment that is known to reverse the negative effects of sleep apnea, right? Okay. And the negative effects would be the hypertension and the heart failure.
Can I just ask you, what does CPAP mean?
All right, so CPAP is continuous positive airway pressure. All right, so the device that literally pumps air into the airway to keep the airway open and from closing off when you sleep. And so it's required for when patient has moderate to severe sleep apnea, right? CPAP is the initial device, but they are BiPAP and APAP. APAP is automated. It's it senses your breath and at times when you're breathing and sends you, gives an impulse of air to keep the airway open. BiPAP is biphasic, so it just doesn't continuously send air through your airway, which is a little bit uncomfortable, right? So CPAP or BiPAP or APAP, whichever one, is the only treatment modality known to reverse the negative effects, which is the hypertension and the heart failure. However, a lot of patients don't comply with the devices. And some patients may have the body habitus that is beneficial to do surgery. So we will do upper airway surgery, tongue-based reduction, removal of the tonsils if they enlarge, palate reduction surgery, patients who may have a deviated nasal septum that could contribute to snoring and sleep apnea, because if you have nasal obstruction and you breathe with your mouth open, your tongue tends to fall back, that narrows the area, and that could actually trigger you to have apneic spells and sleep apnea, right? So so certain patients may fit the criteria to undergo upper airway surgery, and that may either reduce the need for high pressures in the CPAP that would make it uncomfortable, or might totally negate the requirement for use of a CPAP machine. So it's quite multimodal, and if there's a patient who is morbidly obese or significantly obese, and they have metabolic disease like diabetes, hypertension, and so on, they may actually benefit from bariatric surgery or weight reduction surgery.
Hmm. Docs, I have two questions here from someone, but before that, don't forget you can call us at 627-3223, 625-2257. You can even send us a WhatsApp message on 306-1065. We are on Doctors on Call with Dr. Nadira Rambukas and Dr. Richards. Dr. Richards, good morning. I have been snoring for a long time, over 20 years. Does that mean I have obstructive sleep apnea?
Well, we may need to ask you a few more questions. Mm-hmm. Snoring is just one part of it, but there is online surveys, particularly a questionnaire called the Epworth Sleepiness Scale. Right, you could Google it, and based on your symptoms, they ask you questions based on your symptoms and your tendencies to fall asleep, your sleepiness during the daytime, and so on. Mm. And that will give you a score on the likelihood of you having sleep apnea. Mm. So it's not just the snoring, even though snoring is one of the more common symptoms, when there are other things. So it's not enough to say if you have sleep apnea. Mm. A lot of patients might have a deviated nasal septum, or they have enlarged inferior turbinates from sinus problems, allergic rhinitis, and they have nasal obstruction, so they snore. It doesn't mean that they have sleep apnea.
Hmm. Hi, doctors. Good morning. If you get a 1.07 reading from your CPAP unit, what does that mean? Thank you.
I'm not quite sure of the context. because there are a lot of different, whether that is the pressure that is required to keep the airway open, 1.7 centimeters of water, or whatever the unit they use. I'm not sure of the context.
Mm, okay.
Yeah.
All right, we have a call here. We have a call. Let's take this one. Hi, good morning. You're live.
Good morning, Doc, and your host.
Good morning.
I know your topic is sleep-related, right? And I don't know, maybe this may have, I don't know if it have any connection. You know the word coffee, and it's an age-long thing that you know, from ever since I've been growing up, that you drink coffee to keep you awake, especially like in wakes, in funerals, you used to see only coffee sharing. And then again, I myself haven't woke the midnight oil for quite a number of years. Did drink coffee before the shift, and one wonders, what is the thing about coffee and keeping you awake? And is that a healthy thing, right? You know, because you hear a lot of things about coffee. And but I just want to know if this old age say that, you know, you drink coffee to keep you up awake and whatnot. What is your point on this? Thank you, listener.
Yeah, no, that's a good question.
Thank you so much.
So what coffee does is it blocks the adenosine receptors in the brain, and those compounds are actually related to sleepiness, right? Somnolence, and so it basically keeps your brain awake, right? The negative effects of coffee is that there are other things like niacin and so on in it that gives you the jitters, and you know, it could cause insomnia. And one of the more deleterious effects in terms of ENT is it causes relaxation of the lower esophageal sphincter, and it could give you acid reflux. So in patients who have like insomnia, chronic insomnia, problems sleeping, I mean, we tend to limit the amount of coffee they take, especially in evening times when they will be going to sleep. But people who are shift workers, their sleep cycles are a bit different, right? So I think you mentioned he takes it before he goes on shift. So they may have totally flipped around circadian rhythm. Circadian rhythm is basically a rhythm of wakefulness and the time you go to bed, more or less. And it regulates the pulsations of different hormones and when they release in different levels. So someone who is awake at nighttime, he will have a different circadian rhythm. So coffee will affect him differently. But generally, we tell patients to limit their coffee intake, not only because of the effects on sleep and insomnia, but it could have cardiac effects too because of the anxiety, the stimulation of the heart and causing arrhythmias, etc.
Thank you so much for that, doctor. Guys, we are going to take a break. When we come back, we are going to continue the discussions. Keep it locked to Freedom 106.5 FM.
Talk is streaming at freedom106.5.com.
27 minutes after 9 a.m. and welcome to Freedom 106.5 FM. You are on Doctors on Call with Dr. Nadira Rambukas, and we have our guest, Dr. Richards, ENT complications and hearing loss. That is what we are speaking about today. Welcome back, doctors.
Thank you, Cara. And Dr. Richards, I wanted to switch gears a little bit and talk a little bit about rhinitis and sinusitis. I know on Sunday, the Saharan dust would have peaked and everyone is suffering with, sinuses, but sometimes it may be just allergic rhinitis. Could you tell us what is the difference between the two?
All right, yeah, sure. So we call it allergic rhinosinusitis, right? Because it's difficult for the sinuses to be inflamed and the nasal cavity not inflamed. So you have your paranasal sinuses, which is located in your forehead, in your cheeks, and behind your nose and behind your eyes, actually, right? Just for a rough layman representative of where they are. They open into the nasal cavity, right? So what could tend to happen is different things may cause inflammation of the lining of the nose and the sinuses. One of them is allergies, right? And so when you have a peak in the Sahara dust, poor air quality, it irritates the lining of the nasal cavity, causes it to get inflamed. When it becomes inflamed, it produces more mucus, and then it starts that inflammatory cascade where you have cells coming and releasing certain chemicals that gives you all your symptoms, like run watery, itchy eyes, runny nose, and so on. Sometimes you can get a secondary infection. So when the nose is inflamed, it makes it easier for viruses and bacteria to infect, right? Because the defenses are a little bit blunted a little bit. So you get the blockage of the sinuses and you get bacteria growing in there. And then you could get what we call a bacterial sinusitis. So they are different, but they one kind of leads to the other. So in allergic rhinosinusitis, it's allergic in nature. Different things trigger it. One can be the Sahara dust. Another is normal household dust, because household dust mites, the droppings actually, humans are allergic to it. Some people are allergic to pet dander, spores, another big one is mold, right? Those cause irritation and allergic reaction, what we call a type 1 hypersensitivity reaction in the body. So you could react different ways to it.
And how can each be treated? So should you treat it early, for instance, when you have allergic rhinitis so it does not progress to bacterial sinusitis?
Yeah, so one of the things that the big ones, patient always wants antibiotics, right? So as doctors, we have to ensure the judicious use of antibiotics because You may know for the next 10, 20 years, we don't have any new antibiotics coming on board. And we have superbugs being developed because people given antibiotics, not the correct use of antibiotics. So we have a lot of mutation of these bacteria and a lot of drug resistance. So initially, in that phase where it's an allergic reaction, antibiotics is not warranted, right? So a patient, they may call it hay fever, they may have these rhinitis symptoms, the sneezing, the runny nose, the itchy eyes, the itchy throat. So in that regard, you will benefit from a multi-symptom with Panadol, antihistamine that will ease up some of the sneezing and the itchy throat, and a nasal spray, a steroid nasal spray. If the flare-up of the allergies is very severe, systemic steroids may work as well, like oral systemic steroids. That's one of the strongest medication we can use for it. The only time antibiotics, I would start the use of antibiotics is when it's appropriate, when the patient starts to get ill, take a turn for to getting actually systemically sick. So they start to feel weak, body pains, they may start getting fever, the mucus discharge change from clear to more yellow, greenish. Then you say, okay, this is turning into a bacterial infection, patient is getting sick. We call it the double worsening, right? So it starts with the allergic flare-up, they start to feel a little sniffly, they get a little better sometimes, and then a day or two after, they start to get sick again. Then it may be wise to start some antibiotics then, right? And then for long term, we tell patients to abstain from anything that may cause the allergic reaction. So make sure your environment is clean, not too dusty. If there's some hard dust peaking in the atmosphere, people who suffer from rhinitis, sinus disease, and asthmatics, they should not go outside, or if they go outside, wear N95 masks. Make sure your air conditioned clean so there's no mold growing in your household. You may need to use dehumidifiers, air purifiers, and whatnot. And then the last one is, if it's really a problem, then there's condition therapy. And this is where you actually get the purified form of the allergen and you either inject it or you put it sublabial, and you have to monitor the person's response to it. That is like the when it's really, really bad. And a lot of times, it's very expensive to do that.
Desensitization technique.
Desensitization therapy, sorry.
Yes. Do you recommend, because you've seen a lot of on social media stuff like neti pots with nasal lavage and so forth. Do you recommend those?
Yes, I highly recommend nasal lavage with the neti pots, or there's the nasal pure, or those other devices, or you could just, large 60 ml syringe, or those condiment bottles with a tip that you put ketchup and mustard in. You could actually get one of that and just make your own saline at home. Yeah, you could buy it brand new, so it actually holds more fluid and it gives you a better lavage. So you make your own saline, but you could boil water and you add 1 teaspoon of salt for every 500 mils of water. And you could actually do your own nasal syringing using that solution. So you don't necessarily have to buy the commercially available setups, because they have those that has the packs of salt that you add to water and so on. So whichever your choice, but that is helpful in keeping the disease at bay or keeping it controlled. With old medication, because it refreshes the mucosa by washing away all the allergens and the what happens, bacteria sometimes create what we call biofilm on the mucosa. So that helps to clear all that, so that when you use your nasal spray, it actually gets to where it has to go.
Dr. Richards, you talk about nasal spray and you talk about the saline or saline, right? Mm-hmm. What is the proper way to use it? Because I mean, I've seen persons, they just take the syringe and they squirt the saline up. And is there a proper way to do it that it would be effective?
Yeah, I actually was working on a video for my page to demonstrate how to do it. It's just that after many takes, I didn't like how it looked. But what you do is you lean forward, right, over the sink. I usually do it because I suffer from allergic rhinitis myself. Mm. I do it when I'm showering or right before I shower. You lean over and you insert the tip of either the syringe or the neti pot, and you flush upwards, or you squeeze the bottle. With the neti pot, you kind of have to tilt to, and let it drip out. And it usually runs through the other nostril. Oh. And you repeat from the other nostril, and it will come out the other one.
But how much times it should be done until you feel something different?
So I recommend in one sitting, you use about 500 mils of solution. And until that's finished, that's it. 500 mils per liter. It has to be copious to be effective, especially when there's acute flare-up.
Wow.
After the acute flare-up and everything is controlled, you can maintain it by doing it like once a day with about 500 mil. But initially, when it's really bad, you should do it twice a day.
Mm. All right. Thank you.
Yeah.
Guys, don't forget you can call us 627-3223, 625-2257, and you can even send us a WhatsApp message on 306-1065. If you're now joining us, we are on Doctors on Call with Dr. Nadira Rambukas and Dr. David Richards. We are speaking about ENT complications and hearing loss.
Dr. Richards, just one last question. For instance, in chronic sinusitis, when do you think like surgery would be necessary? For instance, during the sinuses?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yes. So so acute sinusitis is basically acute inflammation of the nose, nasal cavity and the paranasal sinuses. For usually a short period of time, we're talking weeks to probably a month, right? There's a range. We're not too rigid with it because, you know, patients don't present like the textbook. And usually a chronic sinusitis is when that infection or those symptoms continue past like 6 weeks, 8 weeks, going on for 3 months. Yeah. And patients have the anosmia, which is loss of sense of smell, and headaches and so on. So the reason why we give that time frame, particularly that 3 month time frame, that's the time we use to see if the acute attack resolves and the symptoms resolve. So we give patients the maximum therapy of medical therapy, which may include sometimes steroids, sometimes antibiotics, your nasal sprays, your antihistamines, and so on, and your saline nasal lavage. If that doesn't work and the patient still has significant symptoms, then we order a CT scan, right? So usually after about 3 months of patients not responding, then we start considering surgery, right? So we do the CT scan to stage how bad the disease is, to look at the patient's anatomy, and then we consider surgery, discuss surgery with the patient, which is the endoscopic sinus surgery. We go into the nose and we drain the sinuses via the nasal cavity so that they continue to drain and you don't get those symptoms of the retained sinus secretions that cause the headaches and so on.
Okay, thank you. Harold?
Yeah. I know we have a few calls. Let's take this one. Hi, good morning. You're live.
Good morning. Calling.
Morning, yeah. Welcome.
Yes. Look,
Morning.
Good morning. I have been told the idea that if you are healthy to begin with, you can shake off a lot of these things, even if they get you. And most of the times they wouldn't. And I have lived that way for some time now, and I have found it to be true. Now, both my parents were vegetarian, and my father ended up being vegan because he couldn't use milk, dairy, right? So he just passed away at 99. And he was healthy up until a month ago. It is only in the last month or so that he became a little confused. Just confused. Mm-hmm. And I don't hear our doctor here propagating health via lifestyle so much as all the medications and so on. And I taking a minimalist approach, where you only progress the intervention according to the progress of the situation, which I agree with. But what is the opposition on a lifestyle approach to avoidance? And what is your experience?
That's a really good question.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for that. As Doctor would have described in my bio, I am big on wellness. So I'm not your typical surgeon who just prescribe medication and operate. You are what you eat, right? Thing is, a lot of our diets contain a lot of foods that are pro-inflammatory. So particularly number one is the simple sugars, right? Refined sugars actually cause a lot of problems. You mentioned dairy. Particularly in patients with sinus issues, we recommend that they decrease or stop their dairy use, because that actually not only pro-inflammatory, but it kind of worsens the sinus issues with the mucus production. So yes, you can actually, the body have the tools to cure itself from most things. However, there's a big but to that. The type of food that we have access to may not give us that opportunity, right? Because, you know, the yield of the world is not enough to really sustain the population in terms of food supply. So that's why they do all this genetically modification of food and all that stuff. So you may not have any choice unless you grow your own food. And even when you grow your own food, you might have to use pesticides and all these other things to make sure your food grow properly. So it's a balancing act. And the reason why doctors, we have to prescribe, so it's not that I'm defending my colleagues here, but the reason why we have to take our approach is because when patients come to us, they have bypassed that stage where you could cure disease with your lifestyle, because they lived however they were living before. So when they come at us, they come at the stage where the disease is rip-roaring and flared up, where we have to prescribe pharmaceutical grade medication and Western medicine, your surgical intervention and so on. But the lifestyle control of disease is an important thing, and that's what I want to emphasize in my efforts, hosting health fairs and wellness seminars, etc. Because it's not a quick fix. So like you, I would like a lot of people to live like that, you know, take care of their health, eat properly, exercise. And health is not just physical, but it's mental, because your body will manifest. All the turmoil that might be going on in your mind will eventually be manifested by your body.
Dr. Richards, we have another call. Let's take this one. Hi, good morning. You're live?
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
Ms. B, how are you?
I'm good.
Very doctor here. Right. I just want to find out, as we grow older, right, our body seems to have grown into getting more complicated with sickness. So if it is that when we reach a certain age, all the medicine and thing that they have, it is going to help any kind of way? Because what you're saying, they are listening from the beginning. I think I had a problem with the sinus. I just have it real bad. And if it is that inflammatory in your body that causes it more, and what it is, like you were saying, you could mix something and you could help or go to the pharmacy and get it done. Or if you could come and see you to drain out all that fluid, because I just be feeling that thing on my ENT. And I think I really need some good advice on it. Because sometimes I just can't breathe through my nose. So I'm listening off it. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
All right. Yeah. So I can't really assess exactly what particularly the question. If it's nasal obstruction, you have a sinus, and there are different causes of nasal obstruction, right? Allergic rhinitis and sinusitis is just one of the causes. You could have other things like deviated nasal septum, or you probably, which is the most common, you could probably have enlarged turbinates. And those are anatomical obstructions that can be cured with a surgical procedure, right? If you have other symptoms like the sinuses with the mucus production, the sinusitis, mucus production, headaches, facial pain, loss of sense of smell, you may have a chronic sinusitis, which may benefit from certain types of medication and possibly surgery. Now, yes, the lifestyle will help, right? Lifestyle changes, normal herbal remedies and whatnot. It may have some benefit, but as I said before, the stage it has reached now, it's causing severe symptoms. It may be past that stage where lifestyle control will help the disease process. You may need some more active intervention.
All right, thank you so much, guys. We are going to take a break. When we come back, it's much, much more. Keep it locked.
Talk is streaming at freedom106.5.com.
It's just about 49 minutes after 9, and welcome back to Freedom 106.5 FM, where you speak your mind. This is Doctors on Call with Dr. Nadira Rambukas and Dr. Richards. Hi, welcome back, doctors.
Thank you, Carol.
Thank you.
Dr. Richards, you reminded me that tomorrow is World Hearing Day. So could you tell us a little bit about how common hearing loss is and if it's prevalent in our population?
Yes. Hearing loss is quite common in our population, in any population, actually. The most common sensory deficit is hearing loss, right? But it's just a little more difficult to detect because people just, you know, naturally just raise the volume on things and they're less aware of it than, you know, say a vision when they start losing their vision, right? And it's quite common in our population, quite prevalent. And particularly because we have so much lifestyle disease, diabetes in particular, that actually goes hand in hand with hearing loss. Just like how you could lose your vision with diabetes, it's probably more common for you to lose your hearing, right? So that still needs to be proven research-wise. But yeah, it's something that I want to raise awareness on, because we have a lot of inadvertent noise-induced or preventable hearing loss that occurs in our country. And I'm not sure if it's because of, you know, lack of understanding in the workplace, where employers have in these machine shops or factories, or it tends to see it with the international companies or the big companies taking the precautions. But like the local companies, you tend to not see them having the employers have protection and so on and so on, because I'm actually a occupational hearing conservationist as well. So I wear that hat as well. So sometimes I see patients who come in and they say, I have hearing loss, do a hearing test, and you see the notched noise-induced hearing loss pattern, and you ask them, did you ever work in a noisy environment or whatever? And it wouldn't register to them, and they say, no, coming to think of it, yes, I worked in a textile factory or whatever factory, but I was in the office, which was away from it. But unless you had your employers do the industrial hygiene and do the audiometric, the noise testing, the decibel testing, and using a dosimeter to see how much sound or noise you are exposed to and the levels you're exposed to, then you wouldn't know. So a lot of patients come to me and they actually have noise-induced hearing loss that they didn't really know that they got it from the workplace. You know, so that's a big one that we have to raise awareness to.
What about our pediatric population? Because we see kids using AirPods now, because everything is social media and everything is online. Is hearing loss prevalent in the pediatric population, and do we
see? Yes. However, the thing is with children, they are a little more resilient in that their hearing will recover much better than adults. But it is estimated that in the next 10-15 years, there may be about 500 million people with sensory neural hearing loss. just because of their recreational practices, listening to music too loud in the on your headphones and so on. But I don't know if you realize some with these newer technology, they actually reduce the noise levels in the device. So like if you're listening your on your AirPod and you turn the music off, after about 5-10 minutes you realize the levels come down. It automatically does that. And if you're listening at a dangerous level, it will give you a warning. So some of the devices actually come into terms with the social uses of these devices that could be affecting all social practices that could affect our hearing. But simple things I like to point out, like things like going to the theater, the movie theater, you could literally be exposed to damaging sound in a movie theater, right? Levels may be over 100, 120 decibels. And you only are allowed to listen to those songs for less than like 15 minutes or so, right? Without the possibility of permanent hearing loss. So other than that, I like to raise the awareness of people to be a little more aware. We just had Carnival. I could count the amount of people I see actually wearing hearing protection in Carnival. I actually went to a party, and I used to be a steel band player. I played steel band for like almost 20 years. And I went to a party and I checked the decibel levels, and it was like almost 100, right? And there are a lot of kids playing steel band and so on. So I one of my projects is to literally raise their awareness and to, safer, prevention for hearing loss, that type of thing.
Do we screen newborns here for?
So yeah, that's a big topic. One of my colleagues did a research on that. We don't screen universally. We only screen patients who had complications during birth. So like if you had ICU stay, or you had any complications around delivery and so on, then they would send you for screening. But like first world countries, they screen every single person, right? And that has shown to obviously a higher detection rate. And a simple thing, if someone is born with a 20% decibel reduction in hearing levels, right? Their perception of sound in the environment would be so different from a normal hearing individual, right? And this could affect their learning, their social development, their communication. So a lot of these children will be going missed. They will be missed the opportunity to diagnose and literally a simple fix. And these are patients who might be plagued with learning disabilities or different consequences of not detecting their hearing loss early enough. So it's something that we have to aspire to. I think we could get there. There are a lot of people before me who did a lot of research and tried to get it on board. And hopefully this new generation, particularly Dr. Debbie Pinder, but hopefully this new batch, a new generation of ENT surgeons, including myself, could, rally the troops and get it on board. For us to start that universal newborn screening, hearing screening.
And how can adults and kids protect their hearing?
So I tend to give people general health precautions and then particular hearing health precautions, right? So your general health precautions, simple things as eating a balanced, healthy diet, exercising, and so on. All these things that help with lifestyle disease will help with your hearing health, right? There's a particular one. Do not use medications unprescribed or not recommended in the way it was used, what was prescribed to use, right? So a lot of people I've even seen my family members do it. They would use other people's prescriptions Like if, you know, someone had medication for something and they think they have it too, they will use their medication. Or if somebody had leftover antibiotics and, you know, you feel like you get coming down with something, you use it, that sort of thing. That is strictly, that could be very dangerous because some antibiotics could cause hearing loss, right? And using medicines not in the way they should be used could cause problems, right? Simple little things like using aspirin and so on could actually lead to hearing loss, right? So pay attention to things like that. Hearing health in particular, not listening music for too loud, with your hearing devices. If you're doing household work and chores using like a presser washer, a lawnmower, bushwhacker, things like that, leaf blower, you should use hearing protection because if you use it regularly, you will get hearing loss from those devices. If you go to a concert or a fete in our setting, use hearing protection. Try not to go right up on the DJ, on the speaker box. All right? Patients, you should rest your ears. Funny enough, when you go to an event or you go to a concert or whatnot, and you come home and your ears ring in the other day, that is actually temporary hearing loss. Right? We call that a temporary threshold shift. Now, your body ability to recover from that decreases as you get older. So a lot of times you could recover from it, so it goes away and the ringing stops. But if you continue to expose yourself to loud noises, you will get permanent hearing loss. So say if you get a permanent temporary threshold shift by going to listening to loud music and you repeat the action without enough space in between, you could actually get permanent hearing loss. So it will become a permanent threshold shift. And then last but not least, any ailment of the ear,
yes,
visit your doctor. Make sure and seek your GP and your GP, or if you have easy access to ENT. Usually we are very booked because they're not much of us. But a lot of times your GP is able to treat these common ear issues, and they will refer as necessary. Right, because you don't want to take it for granted, right? Protect your ears like you protect your eyes.
Thank you.
No problem.
So, Dr. Richards, we want to thank you for being here today, for being educational and informative. We have to have you back because we couldn't cover all the topics to completion.
Mm-hmm.
And thank you to the listeners and Cara for being here today. So enjoy your day.
Thank you so much, doctors. Yeah. Thank you, Dr. And Richards. See you soon.
I'll leave my contacts. So I have a educational page on Instagram, Dr. David Richards. A lot of the things I talk about here will be posted in videos and slides and so on. Email is drdavidrichardstt@gmail.com and practice number
263-6512. All right. Thank you so much. Thanks for joining us. Right. Thank you, Dr. Rambukas. I'll see you guys next time, next week, same time, same place. Much. Thank you so much.
Talk is streaming at freedom106.5.com.